This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Michelle Skipper stepped up to help when Hurricane Matthew devastated her eastern North Carolina community. She and her husband helped to cook and do laundry for hundreds of people at the local emergency shelter. But Hurricane Matthew was not the beginning or the end of Michelle's service. She and her husband have led mission trips to Nicaragua. She's a nurse practitioner, and she's seen rural patients for over two decades. She's now working to recruit the next generation of rural health care workers. Dr. Michelle Skipper is a clinical professor and the director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Program at East Carolina University, and she is our guest today. Michelle Skipper, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tell us more about Hurricane Matthew. When did you realize that it was going to be the storm that it was?
It really began on Saturday of the storm. We were supposed to have a wedding at our church at 2 p.m. And all along during the morning, my husband called the bride and said, are we really going to have this 2 p.m. wedding? Are we really, really going to have this 2 p.m. wedding? And as the waters began to rise, we began to realize that this wedding was not going to happen. But it did. He waded water in his four-wheel drive truck, as did the bride and the groom, to
he's
get to the church.
He's a pastor, right? Yeah, okay.
And but later into Saturday night, and in particular on Sunday morning, we realized that, there were at least 12 to 18 inches of water throughout our small community.
That's when you went to the emergency shelter?
We did. My husband is a well-known cook, likes to cook and feed for big groups. And so the town manager called and simply said, Bruce, we have all these folks at the shelter and nothing to give them to eat. But this was at our local high school, and our high school cafeteria was sitting there full of food that was thawing because there was no electricity. Mm. So it simply began that way as Bruce going to cook hamburgers and hot dogs, and we realized very quickly it was going to evolve into a much bigger event.
Well, nothing simple about that. What's it like to cook for hundreds of people?
Well, thankfully, he knows how to do those things. And we were also assisted by one of the full-time cafeteria workers and a dear friend who runs a restaurant in St. Paul's. And so they knew how to calculate for 200 people how many ham sandwiches that would be and how many grits you needed to make for breakfast. And that's definitely his skill set.
And you had not only your immediate community, but other people from other parts of Robeson County were coming to that shelter, right?
Correct. The community where we live, St. Paul's, is right off I-95. And so we not only had stranded travelers who were on I-95 and could get to our area, but other communities in Robeson County, shelters opened in nearly every town and at every high school. But we got power, electricity back on Monday. And so other shelters began to send folks to us, especially those who had medical needs and needed oxygen tanks hooked up, who had more chronic health problems and those kind of things, because we did have electricity.
Of course, a storm, the magnitude of Matthew, what it became, is devastating for anybody in all communities. But in Robeson County, we're looking at some of the most vulnerable people and vulnerable families in North Carolina, right?
Absolutely. The town manager said to me on Sunday, said, Michelle, where did these folks come from? And I said, you know, JR, these are the last and the least. These are the folks who didn't have a way to get out of town. We were so blessed to have other nurses from public health and folks with us those days who could patch together what we could for the folks who were there. But we definitely had some very sick and chronically ill individuals.
And you had already been doing work at the rural health clinic, right?
Correct.
So you knew, I mean, must have known a lot of these folks from that work as well.
Absolutely.
You mentioned service, and of course, this is we're talking about the service at Hurricane Matthew, but it didn't start there. It's been a big part of your life, right?
It always has. We were raised in, both my parents worked in the fast food industry. My dad, in particular, worked for the McDonald's food chain and established many of the McDonald's that were in the Charlotte area in the early 1970s. And so customer service has always been a part of who we are.
You got pressed into service, although not necessarily behind the counter. You were doing some work as a mystery customer for McDonald's for a while, right?
Absolutely. My sisters and I were frequently mystery shoppers for my father. You have to realize this was pre-internet and cell phones. And so when my dad needed to do customer service surveys in other restaurants, he sent us in to write down the prices that were on the menu, to order a meal, and to come back and report to him if we were presented the food in the way we should have been.
What was that like for you? How old were you when you were doing that?
I was probably 10. My middle sister was 8, and my baby sister was a toddler.
Now, did you, I mean, how did you feel? I mean, it's a little like spying.
Sure.
How did you feel about that?
Again, it was part of our family culture. Yeah. You know, yeah. We didn't think really anything about it. In fact, I think we were probably proud that he trusted us to go inside and do those kind of things for him.
Plus, you get all those, you know, Big Macs and hot apple pies. Things like that. And you were doing that kind of work. Did you have a vision for yourself at that time? What were you imagining that you were going to be doing?
I always thought healthcare, especially by the time I was in high school, I always thought healthcare would be the direction I went. My parents were the first generation to leave the farm and move to a more urban area. And that expectation that we would at least go to college somewhere was always out there.
So they were, as you say, they had that expectation. Did they make suggestions for you? You talked about health care. Did you voice that, and were they very supportive of that?
They were very supportive, especially a health occupation student in high school and sort of moved that way. I originally thought medicine. I thought physical therapy. I thought many careers in healthcare, and nursing was further down the list. It was not until I finished a bachelor's degree that I went back to nursing and realized that that was the career path that I needed to be on.
And you talked about your parents being the first generation off the farm. Did that mean that were you visiting your relatives on the farm?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, both sides of my grandparents grew up in the same rural community in Anson County, North Carolina, just a couple miles apart from one another. And both my grandfathers had full-time day jobs in different industries for the state and for a concrete factory. And then they also farmed in the evenings. And then their parents were full-time farmers.
I wonder how this worked for you, having a, you know, sort of a leg in both worlds, because, you know, your parents have left the farm. They want that for you. You need to get your college education and get out. And now here you are back in rural areas. Had you always had the idea that you were going to continue to serve in a rural area, or did you at one point say, this is it, the big city and medicine is for me?
I was born in Charlotte, but we really lived in some of the more small communities around Charlotte. As Dad worked for the McDonald's chain, we lived in Monroe and Matthews and Salisbury and other small places. So that's always appealed to me. Being in areas where you know your community has always had a large appeal. And like you said, I always have felt I had a foot kind of in both worlds, and still do, that I live in rural Robeson County but work for one of the largest universities in the state, and able to juggle that.
You chose to go to St. Andrews Presbyterian College in Eastern North Carolina for undergrad. What drew you to St. Andrews?
The small town and small size of that college. It was a faith-based university, and about an hour and a half. We were living in Monroe at that time, and I was the firstborn and the first to leave home from college. And so that was a nice mix. I had a high school guidance counselor who at the time said, "Michelle, you need to go somewhere small, go somewhere private where you can be a big fish in a small pond." And that really stuck with me. He was right. And I had a wonderful experience at St. Andrews, and wouldn't trade that for anything.
How did you take that at the time, though? When somebody says you need to be a big fish in a small pond, you're in high school. How did you receive that when he said
it? Believe it or not, I'm an introvert by nature, so that was fine. It certainly led me to choosing between several small colleges. I ended up going to larger colleges later in life when certainly I had been away from home and had some time to establish myself and see how the rest of the world worked.
Your dad wanted you to be a nurse, right?
He did. He actually promised to buy me a brand new red Mustang if I would stay home and go to nursing school. And I turned down the red Mustang to leave to go to St. Andrews.
Well, but you were thinking of a career in medicine.
Could
you have just, you know, got in the car and change your mind?
Medicine was more expensive, longer, looking at things. And like I said, there was a nursing school very close to home that Dad really wanted me to stay.
But you really, so you had your eyes, heart set on becoming a doctor. Was
correct.
The point. It wasn't not just a career in the nursing profession. Got to St. Andrews, a small school. How were things for you there?
It was a wonderful experience. I met folks from all over North Carolina and, in fact, all over the world. And probably one of the most formative experiences for me at St. Andrews is they have had a long legacy of college education for the handicapped. My work-study job in the first year that I was there was to feed a college student his meals, something I'd never done. And I was inspired by many of those who on the surface look like they would not be able to achieve a college education because of their physical limitations, but who certainly could overcome those things. And some of those folks became my best friends.
Your dad wanted you, we talked about that, but your dad had his first heart attack when you were a freshman. What effect did that have on you?
Yes, sir. That was in October of my freshman year at college. And my middle sister was a freshman, was still in high school at that time, and younger sister at home. And they certainly stepped up to help my mom take care of my dad. He continued to work off and on those 4 years until he finally passed away when I was a senior.
We'll talk more about that and find out how Dr. Michelle Skipper became a clinical professor and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Program at ECU when our conversation on the state of things continues. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and I'm talking to Michelle Skipper today, who grew up outside of Charlotte but has lived and worked in eastern North Carolina for a large part of her life. She's a nurse practitioner who treats patients in a rural clinic. She's also the clinical professor and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Program at ECU. Dr. Michelle Skipper is my guest on The State of Things today. You know, we talked about your dad having his first heart attack, and you began to think about having begun your medical education, or at least at the earliest stages, a little bit about his lifestyle and that sort of thing. Did you talk about that, and did his lifestyle change after that first heart attack?
It would change for short periods of time. He and my mother rarely argued about anything, but cigarettes was the thing they argued about. And at looking back now with the education I've had, I realized that he was addicted to nicotine. He would have a heart attack and 6 weeks later would be back smoking again, and could not stop. And there were not interventions at that time. There weren't medicines. There weren't other things other than behavioral therapy and those things. And, you know, some poor dietary choices and other things were contributors to his ultimate demise.
You passed away when you were a senior in high school, and you wanted to come home and help your mom and others, right? Talk about that and the effect that it had on you as a senior when your dad passed away.
Sure. He died just before Christmas. In fact, he died the day before I was supposed to have gallbladder surgery. And so, you know, that got postponed. But during the Christmas break, and St. Andrews had at that time what was called winter term in January. And thankfully, I had enough credits, and my academic advisors and the faculty I worked with there allowed me to stay home during January term. So I really had about 6 weeks to help my mom get reestablished and settled and think about what life was going to look like, and then could go back and finish my senior year. I would not have been able to do it without the support of that faculty.
Mm-hmm. And what about your family? Were they also pushing you back? I mean, I can imagine some of the tension wanting you home and all the support. And on the other hand, you're just about to finish up.
Sure. And I think the overall decision was that I needed to go back. I was so close to crossing the finishing line and so close to graduation. Again, a milestone that no one else in our family had done.
Your maternal grandfather had a saying that helped you through tough times. Tell us about that.
It's a line from Amazing Grace, and we say it in our family a lot. It's in the third verse. It says, His grace has brought us safe thus far, and His grace will lead us home. When, you know, and my mother has warped it a little bit to say, God has not brought us this far to turn back now. Why should we worry?
You didn't. You went back. You finished. A hospital near St. Andrews approached you to see if you were interested in pursuing nursing. Once again, that came up. What happened then?
That was in the nursing shortage of the late 80s, and I had made friends with the director of nursing at the hospital in Laurinburg at that time, and she encouraged me to think about nursing again. Friends of mine were all moving to Chapel Hill, and so that sounded like a great idea. I could go to Chapel Hill for 2 years, continue to live with roommates that I knew and loved, and then made that promise financially to come back to Scotland County to work in their hospital upon graduation.
So you did that for a while.
I did that for 6 years. And 3 years into that stint, I was in the newborn nursery in the neonatal ICU. And 3 years into that time, Duke University approached me and others in our area with a nurse practitioner program that was going to be funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for nurse practitioners who wanted a Duke education and could not move to Durham. And so 24 of my peers in surrounding areas went through that program over a 3-year period. And I would say probably 20 or 21 of those folks are still practicing in Eastern North Carolina as nurse practitioners.
Was there an obligation to stay if you had been through that program?
There was. That was kind of the intention. And the Office of Rural Health gave me some additional funding to complete that Duke education on the promise that I would stay in some rural area. And thankfully, at the end of that time, a rural clinic that the hospital owned had an opening, and I was just able to seamlessly transition into the community where I already was.
Talk about the role of nurse practitioners, particularly when it comes to rural health care and the need that nurse practitioners are filling.
Sure. Nurse practitioners, many are from rural areas. They're well-versed in the culture of rural health. They are understanding of the barriers that rural patients may face. And so many nurse practitioners end up in communities where they are from. And so they know their patients, they know their communities, and they know the resources. And it's just an amazing connection that helps everyone.
But in the state of North Carolina, it's one of, I think, only a handful of states that still has this requirement that you be supervised, that nurse practitioners be supervised by NMD, right?
Correct. We are one of the few, primarily the states that have physician supervision remaining, are located in the southern part, the southern belt of the United States. And different states have different models. But yes, in North Carolina, we still have physician supervision.
What's the effect of that?
The physician I work with, he and I are colleagues and peers and friends, and we have been for many years. We collaborate together to do health care daily. He's an OBGYN. He does surgeries and delivers babies. I don't, but I manage cholesterol and pap smears and birth control and other things better than he does. So in real life, in our rural clinic, it's a collaborative practice.
For you, what is the effect overall on healthcare and rural? It would seem to me that that might limit the role of nurse practitioners or the growth of nurse practitioners. Perhaps not. Maybe it's a fine.
It may be a fine line, but it restricts. There are some financial barriers, certainly, to licensure costs and supervisory costs. Many of my peers own their own businesses, and the nurse practitioners are the owners of their business, but they have to employ a physician to be their supervisor. In the financial part of that, they could employ another employee. They could add another job to North Carolina. They could save health care costs for our state.
Can you give me an idea what that pay? So you have to pay to be supervised is the point. How much is
Well, different organizations do that differently. But on average in North Carolina, I would estimate supervising physicians are getting anywhere between $1,000 and $1,500 a month, and other places more.
How common is it, in your case, you were a nurse and then you were invited to participate in this practitioner program for Scotland County, sponsored by Duke. How common is it for nurses to become nurse practitioners? Is that usually the route?
It's a growing field, but it is a definite higher level of accountability for patient care. It is simply not another degree to add on for an increased financial gain. There's much more to it. Much like medicine, when you're taking that responsibility on to be that person's health care provider night, day, 24/7, their chronic illness, the good, the bad, the hospitalizations, it becomes much more than working a 3-to-11 shift at the hospital and going home.
But I wonder about that 3-to-11 shift and the kind of experience that you get. Yeah, sometimes I wonder if all physicians, MDs, nurse practitioners, shouldn't have some kind of experience like that to bring to their then professional practice as they become doctors. How is it important? Did it inform your work as a nurse practitioner to be a floor nurse for a while?
Absolutely. And one of the best things about being a nurse practitioner is, by law, I don't have a license as a nurse practitioner in this state. I'm approved to practice as a nurse practitioner. My license is as a registered nurse. And so any nurse practitioner who's in this state has that nursing background.
And what kind of work, let's get back to the nursing that you did in Scotland County. What were you doing there?
In the newborn nursery and neonatal ICU, which is a level 2 nursery, which is kind of the middle of the road. I had a wonderful group of pediatricians who were my mentors and trainers, and a wonderful LPN who was the first nurse who trained me. I was fresh from my bachelor's degree program, thought I knew everything about nursing, and this older LPN who had worked in the newborn nursery in that area in the 60s trained me and taught me everything I needed to know about being a nurse. She also trained me a lot. She's one of the mentors that I fail to recognize a lot of times. In those days in our area, there were segregated nurseries. And so she worked through that process with these pediatricians when the baby nurseries were integrated in hospitals. So she was not only a valuable resource to me as a nurse, but just as a historian.
When you finally got your nurse practitioner and were certified then to practice, what was your choice? What did you choose to do?
I did 6 years of primary care and family practice in a small clinic that, again, was owned by the same hospital system in a community about 10 miles north of Laurinburg, a little community called Wagram, North Carolina.
And what kind of work did you do there?
Primary care. Again, we were the only medical office in town. So when I first began there, not only did I see the patients, I supervised the staff, did the bank balances, paid the light bill, did all those things.
Maybe you've just answered my next question, but there might be more to it than this. What are some of the barriers? We keep hearing about shortages of certainly doctors and certified health practitioners in rural areas. What are the barriers?
One of the barriers is the capital it takes up front, I think, to start a practice. I know so many nurse practitioners who would like to own their own businesses, but they need the capital up front, and then they need ways to work with insurers to make sure that we're getting fair and equal compensation for the care that we're providing.
Right, and that's that complicated office setup that probably occupies more of your time because of our private pay system. It's more complicated than it would be if we had a single payer. Let me ask you this. I need to know about meeting your husband. There is a story.
That is the best story of all.
Let's tell that.
I sat down at a church dinner with a mutual friend who said, "I'm going on this mission trip to Nicaragua, and I think you ought to go with us." And I had just changed jobs, and it made no logical sense for me to go at that time, but I said, sure, I'll go. And so on that trip, I met my husband, who had lived 15 miles down the road from me for 15 years, but we had never crossed paths.
You met your husband there. He's the man who would become your husband. How did that go? You're in Nicaragua. And again, you're sort of at loose ends at this moment, right? You're without a job. Oh, well, what the heck? I'll go.
Right.
Tell us more about what you did there and how that encounter with the man who would be your husband went.
Sure. We do health care there, water filtration systems, veterinary health, lots of different kind of health care and meeting people's needs in Nicaragua. We began to talk to one another and develop a friendship early in the week. But by the end of the week, I was sick. I had a great case of traveler's diarrhea as we were traveling back to the capital, and he took care of me. In that day when I was very sick with vomiting, diarrhea, and all the things that are associated with that, he came to my room and he said, "I have a clean pair of boxer shorts. Would you like to have them?" And I thought in that moment, I need to pay some attention to this guy. He's willing to share his last pair of boxer shorts with a relative stranger.
That is the most romantic and lovely love story I think I've ever heard.
It absolutely is. The minister who did our wedding shared that in the homily. Don't let the world tell you where to find marriage. You can find marriage in a third world country when you're sick.
There you go. And to include it in the homily, I think, is even more exquisite. You became married. Now, he was older, older.
Yes, 14 years old.
And talked about his journey, which was not on the straight and narrow from the very beginning. He was on a journey as well.
Correct. His father also died when he was a senior in high school. And we talk very frequently about the differences in our journey, where thankfully I had the support to stay on a positive journey. He made some negative decisions in those days coming out of high school and lived a life, as he would say, in the world for many, many years, experimenting with things of the world that he thought would make him happy. But in 2006, realized that that was not the path for him. And we married in 2013 and or 2003, sorry. Then he got into ministry a couple years later.
And so I was going to say he ultimately became a pastor, which is something that he can bring to his work, I'm guessing. Again, his experience in the same way that you can bring nursing to the role of nurse practitioner, I would guess. He brings some of his journey into his experience.
Absolutely. If you would ride down Broad Street in our community and look at the front side of our church, you would think, look at this beautiful historic structure, beautiful church. And it is a very beautiful place. If you go to the back door of our church, it's a public alley where there are some not so beautiful things that happen there on a daily basis with drugs, alcohol, sex work, those kind of things. And my husband ministers to those people all day, every day in a way that he brings to the table that I could not.
And but again, this gets to some of both in his profession and yours, the need for relationship in these communities, because we've seen programs that ask people to stay in communities in exchange for an education. Maybe they're not from those communities. How does that work out when you bring in people who are not really from those communities to serve in a place where it's just not familiar to them?
Correct. In healthcare in particular, there are times that just doesn't work. Sometimes folks acclimate and healthcare providers acclimate to communities and make commitments to be there for the long haul. Unfortunately, more often we see folks who come in for short times of loan repayment, or they come to a rural area and realize very quickly that that's not for them. And so it ends up affecting patient care when you have a rapid turnover of providers.
Well, how does it affect patient care? I mean, if somebody else comes in and takes their place, then there's still somebody there, right?
Right, but you tell your story. You have to tell your story over and over and over. And maybe your medical history doesn't get translated from one person to the next. And maybe your family medical history isn't as known to the stranger as it is to the person who already lives in your community and probably knew your family already.
Well, talk about that, because some of your experience in the rural health clinic offered you some insights into the health and well-being of people who you saw because you were living among them. You could go places. I mean, you can give us examples of sort of going to lunch and noticing that maybe some of the dietary habits they had confessed to you or professed to you weren't quite as accurate as you witnessed.
Correct. Especially when I was in the clinic in Wagram, this small community where there was a gas station was our only option for lunch. And I frequently saw my patients there making poor food choices and other health habit poor choices.
So what do you do? Again, here's a case where you would think intimacy, living among people, can be a real benefit. But can you go there? Can you say, you know, look, Charlie, I saw you with that quart of beer and the fried chicken, and I'm telling you, it's not going to do you any good.
Sure.
Can you do that?
You can. And of course, you have to have those professional boundaries. But certainly those information things can be done in candid conversations. And in the next office visit, say, you know, let's be honest, I saw you when I was buying my own lunch that might not have been the best food choice, making some really bad food choices. And, you know, can we talk about how often this happens in your life and what you might want to do to change it?
That Slim Jim that I bought wasn't fried.
Exactly.
You know, you can say that. What about the health needs in rural communities? Are they categorically different? What should we know about the health needs in rural communities?
The opioid epidemic is worse, I think, in rural areas than many people realize. We talked earlier about some of the changes in agriculture and textiles and those kind of things in rural communities. And unfortunately, drug trafficking and opioid use and the sale of opioids is a financial opportunity for people in rural areas that lead down a road of destruction and addiction that is devastating to our area. We continue to have access to care issues, transportation, financial issues, barriers. You know, women's health care is the area of practice I do primarily now, and the number of patients who simply can't get a ride to my office to get their birth control.
You talked about, I think you put your finger on something that maybe we should talk a little bit more about. Rural areas have always been nominally less wealthy than the urban areas, but they were connected. There was industry and communities were held together because agriculture, while nominally less well-paying, was enough to keep food on the table and communities together. Now, with the loss of some of those industries, including changes in agriculture, I think what you're seeing and what you're saying is these communities have broken apart, and that more than the nominal wealth or as much is playing a part in what you're seeing.
Correct. And just the devastation that it does to families with children. Our church hosts a bi-monthly food pantry, and the number of single mothers and single fathers who come to our food pantry for assistance for the very basic needs for children, things that you wouldn't think about in this day and time that children still need to survive.
Like what?
Food.
Yeah.
Simply
it's
food.
Just coming for food. I'm talking to Dr. Michelle Skipper. She's clinical professor and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice program at ECU. We're going to talk more about her transition back to women's health care and the role faith plays in her work. All of that on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Dr. Michelle Skipper, who leads a life of service. She and her husband helped hundreds of people stranded by Hurricane Matthew. And before she worked as a nurse practitioner in her primary care, she also worked in primary care clinic in rural communities. But after 6 years of primary care work, she wanted to get back to women's health. Tell us more about that.
The physician I work with is a longtime friend and would come to labor and delivery when I worked in the newborn nursery, and we would share cups of coffee during the night while we were waiting on a baby to be born. And he'd approached me for many years and said, please come work in my practice. And so in 2003, when the Nicaragua trip came and it looked like I might be getting married and life was about to change, he made that offer and I took it. Because again, women's health has always been my first love.
And are those needs, again, we talk about rural communities and whether or not there's any difference with urban communities or healthcare in other places in America. What about the challenges there in rural communities?
Absolutely. Many of the hospital systems in our area have stopped doing deliveries. So we have patients sometimes who we're on the North Carolina-South Carolina line, so we may have some from upstate South Carolina, but it's not uncommon for us to have patients who drive 45 minutes to an hour for office visits.
Yeah. In 2006, you joined the faculty at ECU, the ECU College of Nursing. Tell us about that decision.
I did. That decision came again, from a longtime mentor and friend who was in a faculty role. And it was about the time that Bruce was entering ministry. In the United Methodist Church, the bishop decides where you live. And the online nature of the program at East Carolina was appealing to me because, not knowing exactly where we might live, I could do the kind of work I wanted to do online from wherever we might have been.
As faculty?
You yes.
mean as faculty? What was the program like there? Because I know ECU certainly has, in the medical school, the Brody School, has a particular interest in and focus on rural health care, right?
Yes, sir. Primary care, and especially in the mission and vision of the College of Nursing, and in particular, our program is to provide clinicians to Eastern North Carolina. We recruit that way. We try to help folks that way, and we encourage them to stay in Eastern North Carolina to take care of people. The College of Nursing was a school of nursing when I began in 2006, and our nurse practitioner program at that time was a master's level nurse practitioner program, as many were at that time and still are around our country. In 2013, our program transitioned to the Doctor of Nursing practice, and in 2015, I was asked to lead that program.
Tell us more about that, the Doctor of Nursing practice. We're seeing more and more of that. And sort of masters of nursing programs fold in favor of this kind of program. What does that provide us? What's the rationale behind that?
The rationale provided is that the level of care nurse practitioners were already doing really is at a clinical doctorate level. And it goes along with other disciplines who had already moved to clinical doctorates. Speech audiology, physical therapy, many other disciplines had moved to clinical doctorates. And our national associations began actually many years before 2013 to say the entry level to practice as a nurse practitioner ought to be the clinical doctorate.
Does that act as a barrier? Is it an enhancement? What does it do to attract people to the program? And again, if you're trying to fill the ranks and the need in rural areas like rural North Carolina, does it help?
It will help. It may take a little longer to go through school, and there are certainly some challenges there that students face. But our goal has always been that we're going to put that advanced practice clinician in Eastern North Carolina who knows how to do more than treat medical and healthcare issues. They need to know more than how much penicillin it takes to cure strep throat. They need to know what the billing and insurance liability is for that. They need to understand how many cases of strep throat are in their community. They need to be able to look at macroeconomics and public health in a larger way in their communities so that it's not a day-by-day, case-by-case, patient-by-patient kind of visit, but they understand the trends of health care that are happening in their community. And that doctorate gives them the education to do that.
Now, you and your husband started leading your own mission trips to Nicaragua in 2007, right?
We did. We went with a team in 2003, and then in 2007, we began taking our own teams, and we have gone annually since that time.
What kind of work do you do there?
I typically lead teams of nurse practitioners and physicians, typically have 3 or 4 nurse practitioners and 1 or 2 physicians with us. And we average on a daily basis seeing anywhere to 50 to 300 patients a day.
Well, and this is just, you know, basic primary care kinds of work.
It's very basic primary care. We are very fortunate. The non-government organization we work with is called LA Adante. And with the beauty of the internet, we can communicate with them before we arrive. And they go to local communities and talk to a community leader in that area. And we have a wonderful physician we work with there and say, okay, Dr. Medina, I have 5 providers who are coming on Tuesday. Line us up 300 folks. And he will go to those communities, talk to the leaders and say, okay, tell me the 300 people in this area who most need to be seen.
When you see the 300 people in an underserved area who most need to be seen, they have probably not seen anybody for a long time. They probably have all kinds of untreated, perhaps chronic illnesses. What happens then if you spend 2 or 3 weeks or a week there and you're able to diagnose and then you leave and then, or you order a test and say, ah, clearly this requires a test. Well, that's what they haven't gotten. What happens? What's the next step for them?
Sure.
In these underserved areas?
Absolutely. And that's the reason we work with this non-government organization that works with this physician. Dr. Medina is a wonderful friend and local contact there. And any of those situations, we keep notes of our patients and he follows up. Nicaragua does have a public health system, but it's cash. And if you're not able to pay, you're not able to be seen. But they do have some government-owned clinics, and Dr. Medina is actually employed by one of those. And so he follows up our chronic folks. Mm-hmm.
Faith has always played a very big part in your life.
It has. I'm a cradle-to-the-grave United Methodist. I've never not known being part of church and part of the faith tradition.
Can you work that into your practice? Do you talk to people about it?
Absolutely. Many of the mental health illnesses, even some of the chronic physical illnesses, I think folks endure. They could endure in a different way if faith was part of their background.
Is that something? I guess you have to play that hand lightly to make sure that that's something they're receptive to.
Sure.
Yeah. And sure. When you do, in terms of you, the people you see in rural areas, is there more of that, less of that? How important is that still today in rural America?
I'm very thankful. I think it is more common and more approachable. And again, in small town America, most folks know that I'm a pastor's wife, so that I'm typically approachable for those conversations. And sometimes I'm the person who brings up that conversation. And certainly if a patient asks for prayer, I am certainly thrilled to do that. Or sometimes I've initiated that conversation and said, you know, so many of the things that seem to be going on with you, I really think, you know, may I pray for you for these conditions?
And the fact that your husband is not only a pastor, but a cook, I mean, that can't hurt.
That's exactly right. We're a good combination.
If you could create a public health policy that would address what you're seeing in rural America, rural North Carolina, give us an idea. What are the broad outlines of changes that you'd like to see?
It goes back, I think, globally to education. I wouldn't be where I am had I not been able to get a college education. And until we continue to build partnerships with high schools and mentoring young folks to go to community colleges, 4-year colleges, and those kind of things. And we need in healthcare and in other industry to recruit young, educated people back to rural North Carolina. I think there's this misnomer out there that you can't be educated and rural at the same time, and that's simply not true.
Well, what's the recruiting pitch? Because the fear would be, I've got this education, I'm going to make more money. I mean, I spent a lot of money. I may be in debt for this education, getting more and more expensive, even in state institutions. You're asking me to come to a place where it's going to be harder to pay back that debt and where the money I am making, you know, there are fewer opportunities to enjoy the life that I might be looking for.
Absolutely. The flip side to that is traffic, stress,
there you go.
This pace of lifestyle. My niece and nephew are actively involved in 4-H and other community organizations that tie them back to the agricultural roots of my family. And you can't overstate that. And they're doing it through a civic organization. None of us own a farm anymore. But there are ways, and there are certainly lessons that children, young families learn in rural America that they will never learn in urban America.
Who is receptive to this? Who are the people that you find that are most receptive and most want to be part of your program?
The majority of students we recruit actively are from rural America. They're from Greenville East, or certainly Eastern North Carolina, in those areas where they already practice as nurses. So they are aware of the areas. They are aware of the clinics that are available there for opportunities in Eastern North Carolina as a nurse practitioner, and they're already aware of the impact they can make on their communities.
And what about the structure? We've got some, as you say, free clinics in North Carolina. We're in transition now. There's quite a transition, quite a bit of flux in terms of public health. If that's a policy that you could take a look at, how would you try to structure that and fold some of these ideas into whatever your plan might be?
I think a great combination would be a combination of a federally qualified health center and a public health department. Our public health departments are absolutely the safety net for hundreds of people in Eastern North Carolina who simply have no resources for health care at all, or who may be self-employed and choose not to purchase health care. But the pay structure for there is so different. And the FQHCs do a very similar job as safety gap and primary care preventative services for many, many patients.
Are they able to follow through as well? Again, you know, the problem with the clinic is I set up, I see the patient, I order a test, and now we've got to put you back into the system that's either very expensive or hard to access.
Sure. And keeping those FQHCs locally, to me, is the answer.
Federally qualified healthcare centers.
Yes, sir.
You have seen a change in the institution as well. The Brody School and education, healthcare education in general at ECU is changing and growing. Do you see that growth continuing?
I do see that growth. Now we have a wonderful dental school on our campus that also has satellite clinics in the remote and rural areas of North Carolina. We're also bringing online a PhD in public health. And we've had some public health programs in the past, but moving that to the doctoral level will also give us systematic ability to look at the health care of populations in our part of the state.
We talked about your trips to Nicaragua, and certainly you bring a lot of your assistance and expertise, do a lot of good and help there. Have you seen things in terms of systems and structures in places like that and other places that you've been that we could learn from?
Absolutely. One of the systems that's very different in Nicaragua is your ability to get prescriptions filled in a drugstore, and is a system that we ought to think about in North America. Other than controlled substances and certainly some of the psychiatric mental health medications, most patients can go into a pharmacy and ask for what they need without a provider visit. There's good and bad to that. I think there's overuse of antibiotics there. There's certainly overuse of some things. But overall, it gives that control and ownership of managing your health back to the patient, and it's not dependent on the provider necessarily.
Well, and if you think about the fact that there is an overuse of antibiotics here,
absolutely,
with the prescription system and the opioid epidemic with a very rigid prescription system, and I'm not sure how bad it is in the rest of the world, but here where it's very hard to get that stuff, we have a problem.
Exactly.
So you're seeing those kind of changes in rural life. I think you're committed. You're going to stay there, right?
Absolutely. We are a small family. I've been blessed with my marriage to have three wonderful stepsons, five grandchildren. I have a niece and nephew. My mom is 75 and still thriving and doing well and running the rest of us. And one sister overseas and one sister in Lumberton whose husband is on faculty at Pembroke. So we have all sort of migrated east and plan to stay.
Well, I'm going to take us back to where we started in this conversation, and that was Hurricane Matthew and your service there. How did that, or did it, change your understanding of what community is?
We have known many of our neighbors in St. Paul's for the entire time that we've lived there. Our neighborhood literally is in the same neighborhood as the high school. And so in the 7 days that we provided meals, I was able to serve food alongside some of my physical neighbors that I had never spent that much time with in our community. And it wasn't just my husband and I who made that commitment to serve others. They were all of our neighbors when we realized we needed to do it. Showed up all day, every day. Excuse me. And it's just been a wonderful time to meet people in our community that we would not have known otherwise.
Well, I want to thank you for, and before I thank you, and I know that this is mostly the distress of having to clear your throat. I think you're not becoming emotional over this, but let me ask you one last question, and that is, you're the director of this program now. You've won a statewide service award for your efforts. What's next for you?
That's a great question. I think what's next for me is, again, continuing to, I need a nurse practitioner who is well-trained to take care of me as I get older and as my family gets older. And I have a vested interest in making sure that that person is an ECU grad.
Dr. Michelle Skipper is clinical professor and director of the Doctor of Nursing Practice Program at ECU. You can find links to our conversation at our website, stateofthings.org. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Tomorrow we're going to Greensboro. We will be there live. We're going to talk about the record number of homicides in Greensboro last year. In fact, the fact is that the Guilford County has one of the highest levels of gang activity. Some 40 gangs in Guilford County. Many of the homicides in Greensboro attributed to gang activity. We'll talk about that with a local reporter. And we'll also hear the music of Molly McGinn and Debbie the Artist, all of that when we are live in Greensboro on The State of Things, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.